Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to the New Books Network. This is the Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery Podcast. My name is Lucas Rickert, and welcome everyone. Haggai Ram is an historian of the modern Middle East at Ben-Gurion University of Negev. His teaching and research focus is on the social and cultural history of Iran, on Palestine, Israel, and the Levant region. It's wonderful to have him with us today. Let me tell you about a little bit about what he's written and what we're going to talk about today. He's the author of Iranophobia, The Logic of an Israeli Obsession. He's the author of Reading Iran in Israel, Self and Other, Religion and Modernity. And he's also the author of Myth and Mobilization in Revolutionary Iran. However, today he's here to talk about Intoxicating Zion, a social history of hashish in mandatory Palestine in Israel, which was just published with Stanford University Press. Haggai, it's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Luke.
It seems a lifetime ago that we were in person talking to each other in China, and I got to know a little bit about you. But let's start off maybe with your background for the listeners. Can you tell us about yourself and how you got into the topic of cannabis and hashish?
Oh, sure. I think that you actually slightly mentioned it because for the greater part of my career, I've been a historian of modern Iran, and the pre-1979 Islamic Revolution and the post-1979 Islamic Revolution period. And in my research and teaching, what I try to do is to break free not only of the field's confinement to regional studies and methodological nationalisms, but I also tried to liberate Iranian studies and by extension, Middle East studies from the what I can call the epistemic self-sufficiency of Orientalism as a mode of knowledge and production. Now, insofar as the Israeli academia is concerned, I also endeavored to critique the deficiencies and limitations inherent in viewing Iranian realities strictly through strategic and security perspectives. So although I have established myself as a historian of Iran for over two decades, I gradually became, and how should I put it mildly, a bit bored with it. And so I felt that I needed to infuse new blood into my scholarly passions, as it were. So I therefore set out to discover new fields, new topics to research and teach. So during that pursuit, I encountered, I have to admit, by chance, literature about various histories of drugs, cannabis, opiates, cocaine, but also tobacco and coffee in different places and in different temporalities. Retrospectively, a part and parcel of what I think was Paul Gutenberg, who defined as a new drug history, as the new drug history, which was launched in the late 1990s. This literature examined histories of drugs as parts of larger and connected realms of cross-border politics, economics, and culture, which cannot be studied adequately if we privilege the state as the exclusive category of analysis. So I have to say that I was immediately drawn to the subject. So as I delved some more into the literature, I learned that actually there is no historical study whatsoever on drugs and society in Palestine, Israel, which has been undertaken. So the research project, which I've just completed and you mentioned, which came out with Stanford University Press, which began nearly a decade ago, I guess, was aimed at addressing this lacuna.
I guess I wonder, one question has popped into my mind quickly is, why is there this lacuna? I mean, if you had to speculate about this gap.
Well, since Israel is situated in the Middle East, right? So Middle East histories or Middle East studies has been usually quite late in acquiring new methodologies, new topics. There has been in the past quite a few dissertations, books and articles on drugs in the Middle East, but for some reason, Palestine Israel has not been included, and therefore I thought this is it. I mean, for a historian, this is a gold mine.
This is how
I came to it.
So tell us a little bit about Israel and cannabis in Israel at the present moment. So I don't want to be overly contemporary and presentist. I know we're both historians, but what's the current situation?
You know what? I have an op-ed, which I incidentally have here. I think it would be best if I op-ed, which was published in the liberal Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which I think would be great and would be the best way to start addressing this question. In this op-ed, which was published a couple of years ago, if I remember correctly, it described described the country's Jewish population as a nation of stoners, and quote unquote. And if I can read to you a very short passage from it, I think that would be quite illustrative. Now it goes like this: a love of pot smoking is shared among all populations in Israel. Hilltop settler youth and Tel Aviv radicals, young and old, Knesset members and simple folk, city and country people, religious and secular, everyone loves pot. Marijuana and hashish are the largest common denominator in Israeli society. Despite the common ideals held by hippies in Israel, it turns out that one can be a religious fanatic, a human rights trampling racist, or a warmongering militarist, and still be incredibly good at rolling joints. No problem. Pot couldn't be any more common in Israel. There aren't enough lungs. Okay, so now again, I'm certain that this description of Jewish Israel as a nation of stoners is an overstatement. Yet, a 2017 survey conducted by the Israel Anti-Drug Authority validates this general impression. And also backed it up with hard numbers. The survey found a dramatic surge in the prevalence of cannabis use by Israelis, Jews, and non-Jews alike. 27% of the adult population reported using cannabis in the past year, in comparison to just under 9% in 2009. Now, a comparison which I did with surveys conducted in other countries shows that Israel is probably at the top of cannabis use by adult populations, with Iceland and the US lagging behind at 18 and 16% respectively. Mm. Now, this is not all of the story, because it is vital to note that Israel is one of the first countries to legalize medical marijuana. Furthermore, by running a state-supported program of medical cannabis and cannabis research, Israel became world-renowned for pioneering cannabis cultivation and extraction technologies. So these and other circumstances have combined to currently make Israel, I believe, an international leader in cannabis research, fueled in part by the highest percentage of financial resources devoted to that pursuit by any nation So much so that former high-ranking politicians, including two former prime ministers and retired military officers, retired police officers, business entrepreneurs, and even a Nobel Prize laureate have recently joined Israel's thriving medical cannabis industry. So it is not surprising that in November of last year, Israel's justice minister announced a plan to legalize recreational cannabis within 9 months. Now, I'm also proud to report that I served as an advisor to the Justice Ministry Committee that proposed this plan.
And I don't want to be sensationalist here, but it seems like the country is something of a cannabis superpower.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, it is. It is. Although it has not been legalized yet, I mean, if you just walk out the streets of Tel Aviv, I mean, there is cannabis smell all over. Again, that was before the closure of the corona crisis, but just walking along the cafes and the restaurants and just people out in the street have been smoking like there is no tomorrow.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Maybe I'm going to get a copy of that op-ed you mentioned, and I can send that out to listeners when this podcast goes out as well.
Sure, I'll send it to you as soon as we're done here.
So I've got a copy of your book in front of me, and I know that people can't see it because they're only listening to this, but it's a beautiful looking book. You've already mentioned that it's the first major work to explore the history of cannabis, hashish, in Israel and Palestine. And that's really exciting just in itself. And I suppose my obvious next question has to be where it is situated within the literature with respect to cannabis. Maybe a bit more broadly with drugs, as you mentioned Gutenberg's drugs history as well, the new drug history.
Right. So the thing is here that I, when I set out to, when I researched this book, I came upon really so much previously untapped archival networks, archival documents, which were a goldmine, because again, no historian had ever used them before. So it was
that's awesome.
It was awesome. Yes, it was awesome. And these are documents which I collected from several Israeli archives, in a couple of archives in the UK and archives in the United States, which had addressed hashish, the hashish trade and hashish consumption in mandatory Palestine and the State of Israel. So this was a very exciting. Now I'll be a bit humble here. I'll just say that since drug history should apply global perspectives, because this is, after all, an interconnected world, and one cannot really ascertain or evaluate the history of any kind of drugs just limiting oneself to the territory of one's country. So I think that my book which really follows in the footsteps of you guys. Of the new drug historians. I was introduced to your people's literature. I just followed what you had done and tried to apply it to Israeli history. So I think that since drug history should apply a global perspective, I think that my book is just another missing link or another missing piece in the puzzle that really demonstrates how drug history is really connected, or interconnected, not just the field, but also the topics themselves. So, showing how hashish has been based on gendered class and let's say orientalist assumptions has been done with other books and other articles which I'd read. I just had to follow your approaches and apply it into my study. So I think, again, so this is a missing link that I exposed or that I discovered, which will enable us to appreciate the global reach and interconnectivity of the topic, of the subjects that we're dealing with.
Mm. One thing that occurred to me is maybe not everyone listening has a good sense of what those Orientalist assumptions might be and how they might have been applied or not applied. For scholars of cannabis and its different properties, there's often an understanding that sort of there's stigma and racialized notions that come along with it. But maybe you can just sketch out very briefly or quickly for listeners, what Orientalism means in your book or with respect to hashish.
What my book does in part is to use hashish as a screen on which human beings project their class, ethnic, and gender desires and anxieties. So let me just tell you a little part of my book, which actually address the Jewish attitudes to hashish and the practices related to the drug, and I think that will clarify the question. So as I show in my book, Jews in Mandatory Palestine, I also deal with the Arab population, but that's another part of the story. But Jews in Mandatory Palestine, and I mean here both Sephardi veterans and East European immigrants, they tended to stay clear of hashish. Now, in this, they were particularly receptive to colonial knowledge, which was produced in three main sites: India and Egypt, where the British had contended with cannabis-oriented populations long before arriving to Palestine, and from the Geneva-based League of Nations, whose role, as we all know, was fundamental in shaping displaced, distorted, and even racist ideas about cannabis around the world. So this knowledge molded hashish into a distinctively racialized oriental drug, capable of animating the supposed pathologies inherent in the so-called mentality of oriental peoples, namely inordinate and excessive sexuality, homosexuality, femininity, irrationality, insanity, criminality, indolence, and manipulability. So during the first decades of Zionism, Jews largely refrained from hashish smoking, partly due to its reputation as an Arab vice, and partly due to fear that hashish use by Jews would put the Zionist project in danger of submerging into a Levantine environment. Now, this is not the end of the story, because these colonial or racist or orientalist misperceptions survived the establishment of the State of Israel, and at the same time responded to new demographic and political realities, namely the expulsion and flight of the Arab population of Palestine in the Nakba, and the country's repopulation by Jews from the Middle East and North Africa, commonly known as Mizrahim. So some of these Jews had used hashish in their countries of origin and brought the habit with them to Israel. Other first and second generation immigrants from Muslim countries picked up on the habit in Israel owing to their socio-economic and ethnic racial marginalization. So in this way, hashish became a Jewish so-called problem, where formerly it had largely been considered an Arab one. So although the number of hashish smokers probably, and I have no, there's no way to determine the exact figure, but the number of hashish smokers probably did not exceed a few thousand in the 1950s and 1960s, the habit of these Mizrahim had concretized and dramatized the dominant Ashkenazi class's anxieties about over-Levantinization. Now, at the same time, it also exacerbated the marginalization and criminalization of the Mizrahi underclass in Israeli society. Now, it is perhaps, to understand this Orientalism, it's perhaps interesting to know that the language used in this endeavor, in this campaign, was reminiscent of older European anxieties of reverse colonialism in the late 19th century, which spoke of an insidious invasion of Orientals and Oriental drugs, disrupting metropolitan life and debilitating and immobilizing its citizens. So I think that quite addresses your question.
Absolutely. It's an awesome answer. And I couldn't help thinking that some of those ideas about pathologies and pathologization of different populations, something that plays out in many different countries and is a common tactic often to separate policymakers.
Which is another example. Oh, I'm sorry. Which is another
please.
Example why this should be really researched and explored in a global or at least in transnational perspective, I think.
It's such a sophisticated answer you gave, and I want to make sure that your grandmother, my grandmother, and grandfathers out there have a sense of sort of the key takeaways from the book. So if you were going to sort of communicate this in an elevator to, say, my grandmother, I mean, what would you say?
Okay, that's a very tough question. So let me try to be really succinct here, okay? I think the book has two interrelated objectives. The first one is to follow the transition from mandatory Palestine to the State of Israel in the 1950s and 1960s through the perspective of hashish, which is an illicit commodity, which is smuggled across borders, traded, consumed, regulated, endlessly debated, right? So my book shows that the transition from the Ottoman Empire to the mandatory period, and then from the mandatory period to the State of Israel, were not epochal breakpoints in history. In addition to the persistence of the political and cultural horizons of the country's Jewish and Arab inhabitants, which has been discussed in previous scholarship, my book traces trends of continuity and change in the fields of regional drug networks, criminality, and drug culture, which survived these transitions, albeit in transfigured forms. The second objective, which I also already have hinted to, is to situate the history of hashish in Palestine and Israel in a transnational context. Because the forces that were at play in the rise of hashish culture in Palestine and Israel originated elsewhere in the Levant and beyond. Because contrary to conventional wisdom, hashish consumption in the late Ottoman period appears to have been quite negligible in Palestine.
Okay.
This, as I discovered, began to change with the establishment of unprecedented global and regional controls over opiates and cannabis in the interwar years. So to overcome these incipient drug control regimes, new circuits of exchange linked Palestine and later Israel to illicit supply chains stretching from Lebanon, the producing country in the north, to Egypt, the consuming country in the south, ensuring the smuggling of vast quantities of hashish supplies across its territory, to the extent that Palestine was regarded as the main way station of hashish in the Levant in the interwar years. So this in turn led to a significant increase in hashish consumption by Palestine's urban working class Arab population. So by the 1930s, hashish smoking ran rampant throughout Palestine's urban centers of Jaffa, Haifa, Jerusalem, Acre, Nablus, Tiberias, Ramla, Lud, and even Tel Aviv, the first Hebrew city. And again, venues for consumption, whether makeshift hashish dens, coffee houses, or brothels proliferated in these towns, and many persons could be seen wandering the streets intoxicated. My book also addresses the Jewish part in this equation, which I've already explained previously.
And I just got to underline for listeners that Intoxicating Zion, your book is innovative. This is the first time that these connections have been drawn, and that you've tapped archives that haven't been used before. And libraries and individuals should be buying and reading this book as much as they possibly can. I don't want to pivot too quickly off this book, because we should linger and celebrate it. But I also have to ask, what's happening next? Maybe you're not that kind of guy who is thinking about the next big project already, but I think it seems fair to ask.
Oh, sure, sure. I've already begun thinking about two projects.
What?
Yeah. So there I'll have plenty of work until my retirement. The first one is actually a research project which I already presented at Shanghai last year. Mm. I'm only in the beginning, though. But it explores the links between the interwar Viennese Jewish underworld and the Levant. Because while researching for Intoxicating Zion, I came across numerous archival sources in Israel, Europe, and the United States attesting to the active involvement of many Jewish members of the Viennese underworld in drug smuggling to and from the region. Now, these guys were mainly based in Cairo, and in some cases in Palestine and Lebanon as well. And they specialized in the heroin trade to Egypt, to Europe, and the United States. Now, this revelation was beyond the purpose and scope of my book, so I set it aside for future engagement. And so I recently began working on that. I think this is also a lacuna because that needs to be addressed, because although there are plenty of histories and literary works on the Viennese Jewish underworld and its global reach, right? None have explored its activities in the Arab Middle East. So I'm excited about that. Now, there is another project which I have recently begun exploring, which is crime and criminality in Jaffa and Tel Aviv during the 1950s and 1960s. Now, this too is a byproduct of my previous research on hashish in Palestine and Israel. What I'm particularly interested in is what became known as the large area, Hashetach HaGadol in Hebrew, which is previously part of Jaffa's old Arab city. Now, this area acquired its name at the beginning of the Arab Revolt in the summer of 1936, when the British authorities leveled several hundred houses in the area because they had provided cover for stone throwers and snipers. Home demolition was also carried out as a means of punishment and deterrence and for transforming some of the old city's alleys into patrol routes. The Israeli authorities resumed demolition of the Arab area during and immediately after the 1948 war, with centuries-old buildings demolished and Jewish immigrants from the Balkans and North Africa being brought in to reoccupy their remaining buildings. So by the early 1950s, Jaffa's large area enjoyed a dubious reputation as Tel Aviv's alter ego or underground self. It was a location of casual sexual encounters, a hotbed for crime, drugs, and gambling. And in the process, the area became home to Orientalist fantasies and ethnic demons that created a place of contamination and revulsion, which is the Jewish antithesis to the white city of Tel Aviv, which is perhaps, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So this is another lacuna. Oh, one more thing that I might mention here is that by the mid-1960s, the area was rebuilt into a space of winding alleys filled with craft shops, restaurants, and art galleries, erasing completely the Arabness of Jaffa in many ways, which is, of course, part and parcel of what the State of Israel has been doing since 1948.
I'm really looking forward to hearing about some of the vice and sort of the nature of consumption in these areas once these projects get off the ground, if they're not already off the ground. And
they're hardly off the ground.
For now, then, I'm going to have to content myself with going over Intoxicating Zion again. And I want to just finally to thank you, Professor Haggai Ram, for writing this book and for joining me today. And for all the listeners out there, Intoxicating Zion, A Social History of Hashish in Mandatory Palestine in Israel, published with Stanford University Press, is definitely worth your time. So I would go out there and pick up a copy or get it from the library if you can, listeners. And Professor Ram, thanks again.
Oh, thank you so much for the kind words, and thank you so much for having me. This is a great opportunity. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.